Hi, this is Anthea Williams. Welcome to the Sideshow Podcast, a show by and for artists with disability. Our first season was made under the title Activated Arts. We've uploaded every episode of the first season, and you can listen to them here at your leisure. Hi, this is Anthea Williams, and welcome to 2RPH. This week on Activated Arts, we're talking about comedy and disability. I'm joined by Madeline Stewart and Alistair Baldwin. Madeline has been performing stand-up since she was 16 years old. She's also an actress and theatre maker. Madeline recently received the AMP Tomorrow Makers Award for her work in creating Crips and Creeps, Sydney's first accessible comedy club. Alistair Baldwin is a writer and performer, and you'll know his work from shows like Get Cracking, where he played Matthew in season 2. He also writes for The Weekly and Hard Quiz, and was the Wheeler Centre Hot Desk Fellow for 2018. Alistair is also one half of the comic duo Nemesis. So I think it's pretty much no surprise that the month I'm looking at comedy is also the month where all of my guests have lived with disability from birth. And I'm kind of in that situation too. I've had rheumatoid arthritis since I was 2, so I think that basically counts. So I guess my first question is, do you think growing up with disability is what made you a comic? Madeline, do you want to start?
Yeah, I was actually asked this question the other day, and it really kind of threw me because I thought, like, is it? Is this why? Like, it plays its part, but I think comedy is just naturally a way that people can protect themselves, I guess, if they feel a little different to the pack, I guess, when you're growing up. I think I've always just been funny, and being funny growing up when you have a disability, it enhances your ability to feel included in a group and making friends. And I think that's probably where it began. But as it, you know, being a comedian, I think that started when I saw Adam Hills in Campbelltown. Yeah. And I realized that the people in the community who would usually look at me with pity were staring at Adam Hills and like, oh, wow, we adore him. And I'm like, I want that. Yeah. And so that's sort of what got me into comedy, is that I had this kind of natural skill of making people laugh and making people like me in that way. And then kind of wanting people to see me as more than a person with disability, if that makes sense.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense to me. What do you think, Alistair? Do you think that's what pushed you into comedy?
I think it might be. My feeling is that so much of comedy is about subverting expectations, and being disabled or being visibly disabled in public, people just project expectations on you, a flood of expectations. So it really, I don't know, they're doing a lot of the heavy lifting, and then that leaves you all this room to really just completely cut them down in a funny way. Like, one of my favorite jokes that I do is one of the ones that, I guess, a defensive joke in public when, you know, strangers on trams or whatever will come up to me and point at my leg braces and ask, what are those for? And then I tell them, attention, I'm so glad it's working. And so I think it's, you know, I don't know whether it's necessarily, maybe I would have found comedy anyway, but in a field where it's all about subverting expectations, and in a society where people still have so many incorrect expectations and assumptions about disability, comedy and disability just go hand in hand. And it's no surprise that all of the funniest people I know are disabled.
Totally. I know on the Nemesis, one of the Nemesis recordings, there's a moment where you talk about people who don't have physical or, well, not just physical and neurological or aren't neurodiverse. And what do you call them? You call them like physically and mentally boring.
Oh, yes.
And I'm like, oh, shit, I've actually used that line. Like, you know, my partner is neurodiverse as well. We've had conversations about, you know, if we'll have children, and the answer is we probably won't. But he's like, oh, yeah, they will have a lot of stuff. You know, they'll have arthritis and they'll be neurodiverse. And I'm like, yeah, it sucks that they have arthritis. That's shit. I have been in a lot of pain. But why would we want a neurotypical child? How fucking boring would that be?
So boring.
Can you imagine we'd be sitting in around the kitchen table with them going, we're so disappointed in you. Your brain is just so linear.
I have thought a lot about if I ever had a kid and if it somehow ended up abled. And I'm like, I'm not going to wake up on a Saturday morning to take it to football or whatever. I think there might be a market. You know, the local sperm banks don't let me donate, but I actually think there's a market if I pitch it as, I want a really like tired kid. So they're not constantly dragging you to swimming and ballet and footy and everything. Just, you know, manufacture a little bit of a muscle wasting disease in. Nothing too heavy, but, you know, just the perfect sprinkling. I think that's actually the ideal child.
So, Madeline, Alistair and I have a question to ask you.
Oh, gosh.
Okay. Yeah. And our question.
Are you voting me out of the Big Brother house? Is
this- Look, I actually haven't planned this question previously with Alistair, but he is going to realise at this point that I did some research. So our question is, did you ride horses growing up?
No, of course not. What the? No, I live in Campbelltown. I grew up in... Wait, there are no horses?
Alistair, do you want to explain why I asked this question?
Sure. Well, I feel absolutely blindsided. I often do ask other disabled people whether they grew up riding horses because it is a weird thing that I was made to do as a child, which is hippotherapy, a weird subsidized horse riding therapy that happens in this country that means that people who were disabled as children have about the same rates of riding horses as people who were child stars on the saddle club. And it is such a weird thing, and the reason Anthea knows about it is that I just wrote about it in Growing Up Disabled, that anthology. But well before that, it's been a preoccupation that just for years I was put on a horse and told that it would be helpful or curative or whatever, and never quite worked.
Like the steady clip-clop of a horse's hooves is just the magic you need to be
absolutely. The rhythm, the metronome. Maybe they were hoping that I would just over time fuse into a centaur.
Yeah.
And then at the very least, the horse half would be able-bodied. And then my brain could just be up here making it do human-y things.
And I grew up riding horses as well. I think I rode
from, oh my God.
Yeah. I think I rode from when I was about 6 to about 12. And it was only when I read your article that I suddenly had that realization of like, oh yeah, core muscles. That would have been quite good. You know, like it would have been good for things. And I'm, you know, like I'm terrible at doing things like catching balls and that kind of thing because I just never practiced. But I do have like a bit of confidence when it comes to like, oh yeah, I can get off on a horse and do that. I know how to ride.
Did you guys ever get sent off to those camps? My mum kept trying to send me to camp. You guys remember that, like the special camp for this?
Oh yeah.
Well, yeah, because I grew up in Dickensian England, yes, I used to go to the Crippled Children's Society camps, and that's what it was actually called.
Oh, that's great.
I know. Yeah, Crip Camp. And it wasn't saying it was the irony, like, you know, you would say with Crips and Creeps, or, you know, there was no kind of empowerment of taking over that language. No, it was just Crippled Children's Society. I hated them. I absolutely hated them.
My mum was always confused, like, don't you want to go? It'll be so nice to see other children like you. And I'm like, what the hell? Like, I'm not here to be infantilized by these adults. I'm not going to sing Kumbaya and whatever. I don't know what they do there, but I don't want it.
Look, I went once, and I've got to tell you, I fucking hated it because everyone's got that great narrative of kids with disability, of course, are just naturally incredibly brave just because breathing is brave, right? And I wasn't. And I could get myself hurt quite easily because, you know, I had arthritis. I had the bones of an 80-year-old in my little body. And I didn't want to hurt myself. And the people who ran my camp were constantly pointing at the children in wheelchairs saying, but this kid's doing it, so therefore they're far more disabled than you.
Oh, no.
It's just like people who had absolutely no training and awareness of what actual disability, you know, issues or theory, etc. It was pretty hilarious.
Amazing.
But what I loved about your article, Alistair, was you talked about how you actually were pleased that you spent time horse riding because it was the time where you didn't have to pretend, being able to hang out with other kids who had disability. And I know that Vidya Rajan, who is your collaborator, has ADHD. Is working with people with disability something that you've continued to seek out in your career and in your life?
Well, in the case of Vidya, I'd say we bonded far more over the fact that we're both from Perth, which I do consider a geographic disability, actually. So in a way, we've overcome that.
Excellent.
And, you know, we've really come into our own on the East Coast. No, but I think it is, I mean, it's lovely to work with other disabled people, partly because it's just like, I don't know, you have a shared understanding, and so you're not having to constantly explain why something is messed up and why clearly we'll do this or that. Like, I think when I've sort of worked on like comedy things that tackle disability with a largely abled thing, I think they're surprised that, for me, I think the funniest way to talk about disability in a comedic way is to talk about abled people. Mm. And to generalise about abled people.
Mm.
Because I really think we should just decenter them and talk about how weird Zumba is as a thing and how we can't let them think that being a Zumba instructor is a real thing that they should really be doing with their lives. I think it's gross and I think they should stop. but abled's are so weird, and so I think it's like the way to decenter abledness is to talk about them like they are this cohesive thing, because that's how people talk about disability when, as you were just saying, disability is so diverse. Mm. And you can't just have a neat roadmap for like, well, if you're not in a chair, you're, you know, you can do this, if someone in a chair can do this or whatever. It's not nuanced at all.
Mm.
So it's nice working with other disabled people because you don't have to explain stuff and they're not on edge when it's like, what if we made fun of abled people in this? Whereas I don't know, a lot of abled people, when I make jokes about them, are like shocked that there are jokes to be made about being abled. Like they're just completely taken off guard because they feel themselves as truly neutral.
Yeah, yeah, they really do, don't they?
They're just so weird. How could you be shocked that we're going to make jokes? Like,
I know. And I can say this, my parents are abled, so I have the right to say that they're fucked up.
Is that what was behind Crips and Creeps? Can you tell our audience a little bit about that, Madeline?
Oh, Crips and Creeps. That started, I started Crips and Creeps in 2019, and it started because in Sydney there are no accessible spaces. Like if you do comedy, you're going up the stairs, okay, or down the stairs, or if it is accessible, it's like a really gross CD bar where there's always one drunk guy at the back with a cigarette being like, tell it, honey, you know. Like,
I'm the guy doing that.
I was sick of asking comedy places to like, oh, could you get Auslan maybe one time? Or could we maybe do this in an accessible space one time so my friends can come? And then I got sick of that, so I just made my own. Yeah, it's really lovely. What's really great is obviously we're accessible. We do Auslan interpreting. It's wheelchair accessible. I only employ marginalised acts because, as we've mentioned before, normies are boring, really, aren't they? You don't want to listen to their jokes. They've not got anything to talk about. What I find really interesting, though, is that I thought there would be heaps of people with disability coming along to the events. And, look, there are quite a lot, but I find that it's a lot of, like, young, abled people who they've never been part of this kind of community or part of, like, the queer community, and they're just sitting there kind of like, they're just learning, and they enjoy that the most, that they are subliminally being taught how to behave correctly through humour.
Yeah, that's awesome. Hey, Alistair, how did you get into writing for TV?
The short answer is that I applied to do a Bachelor of screenwriting at the Victorian College of the Arts, which is actually the thing which pulled me out of Perth. So for that, in a lot of ways, it's like horse riding. It really just fixed that geographic disability. And then I was fortunate enough to be selected for this program called Talent Camp, which is essentially like developing screen creatives from marginalized backgrounds over 5 days. And at the very end of it, they brought in some producers, and there was one that worked at Guesswork, which makes all good comedy shows in this country. And so I sort of said, I'm a big fan and I love comedy and host a comedy night and I do improv and it's the only thing I care about. And she was like, maybe we can get you a work placement. So I was able to do a 8-week placement in the writer's room on the first season of The Weekly. Not the first season, the fourth season. It was my first season. So in many ways, it was the first season of the iteration that matters. And by the end of it, they were like, do you just want to stay for the rest of the season? Since then, I've going between there and Hard Quiz at that same production company, and it's a really great thing. And I just love writing jokes for other people as well. It's quite nice to break out of, you know, my own identity and just write for Tom Gleason, who, you know, is very tall and ginger. So he has an experience feeling like an other, but he's just so fun to write for example.
Oh, yeah. Well, he's got that brilliant kind of acerbic voice that must just be really entertaining to get to say some of the nasty things that he says on that show.
Oh, it's the best. I've always said that Tom Gleason is like a straight drag queen because he will just read you to your face and people adore him for it. But, yeah, and that was sort of the path, but almost concurrent to that, I was also just tweeting a lot of stuff about abled people, and Kate McLennan and Kate McCartney saw that, so they asked me to help write some jokes for season 2 of Get Crackin'. So my main advice for anyone who wants to break into TV comedy is to get on Twitter if you aren't already. It's sad that that is my main advice, but it truly is my main advice.
Yeah. I loved that episode of Get Cracking.
The concept was so amazing because I think the Capes initially approached Jess Walton, who's just an incredible writer, to come up with an idea for a segment that would exist in a normal episode of the show. And then Jess came back with an outline for a whole episode. And the Capes were like, well, of course we're doing this. And that conversely meant that they could approach me to come up with ideas for segments and jokes and stuff like that. I owe it all to the Capes, but I also owe it all to Jess, who was like, I'm actually going to give them more than what they asked for and create, you know, job opportunities for, I mean, we only like got able to cast on that episode apart from the Capes. And, you know, we hired a guide dog puppy. We did it all. It was wonderful.
Yeah. And Kate Mulvaney, I had never felt so seen. I actually, of course, know Kate from theatre world, and I just rang her as soon as I saw it to say thank you. You know, like, well, Kate's like a national treasure in training. I don't think she'd get to be called a national treasure in your 40s, but it's clearly where she's going. And I loved it when she called them muggles. I was just like, so brilliant. And I also just loved the Capes. I thought, you've got to be brilliant people to make yourself look that terrible on screen. The way they treated your character Matthew was just too funny.
Oh, it was fantastic. Yeah, the great thing about the Capes is that they are, yeah, really ready to be the villains of that show.
Yeah. And Madeline, you started doing comedy when you were 16, which sounds really young. How come you started so young? How did that happen?
Well, I think Alistair and I might have something in common.
Oh no!
You know what I'm saying. I think we both did Class Clowns, which is with the Melbourne Comedy Festival. It's a competition for teenagers to do comedy. Poor Justin Hamilton had to sit through my first comedy set. It was a sketch. It was awful. And then the following year, I decided, lose the other people, they're dragging me down, I'm going to do stand-up. And then I went really well. I was a national grand finalist, which is, I know, I'm too old to be like, I was a national grand finalist when I was 17, but I'm still holding on to that, okay?
Oh, Madeline, that's my exact story. It was that by virtue of being in Perth it was very easy to be the best person in the States for the people who had heard of Class Clowns, which, not to throw shade in the comedy festival's marketing, was not that well known as a thing in WA. So there was no heats. It was just the state final. It was me and three other people. So I still, as a 25-year-old, am claiming my 16-year-old national grand final.
I think it's really weird, though, going from something so lovely and wholesome, like a lovely little comedy competition with all these celebrities helping you out, to suddenly you're doing gigs in pubs and you're not old enough to be in the pub. So you have to, like, get an adult from inside to claim they'll watch you and make sure you don't drink booze, which it was kind of weird. And then it also, like, brings up the idea of, like, being a young woman in comedy, being, like, in pubs with all these adult men being, you know, male comedians. I don't know how else to describe them. They're just gross. But I feel like sometimes my friends, other female friends, will be like, oh, I have so much sexual harassment in the comedy world. And I'm like, oh, not so much for me. And then I'm like, is it because I'm disabled? Like, no one wants to sexually harass me. Is it like a, is it a good thing?
Or babe, the stats don't bear that out. I really wish the stats bleed that out. Yeah,
but like I find in the comedy, like the rest of the world, obviously, but like in the comedy world, everyone's really, really nice to me. And I don't know whether it's because I'm lovely or whether it's because I'm disabled. So I'm going to start treating people awfully and being like a massive bitch and just being like, now we'll know.
I think it sounds great. Let's see what you can get away with.
Yeah,
absolutely. But people don't notice. I feel like I've really had to perfect being a dick because people just don't see it when it's coming from a disabled person. They're like, oh, they're so sweet. And I'm like, no, I'm being really mean to you right now. No, you and me, let's all three do a heist, you know. Let's really.
Oh, yeah. Hey, so, like, what's next? Alistair, do you want to start out?
Sure. Well, at the moment I'm in development with two projects, which people always say they're disability themed. And I'm like, I've just put disabled people in it because for me, they're my neutral character base. Mm. And for me to like write an abled person is more effort. So they are disability themed in the sense that there's more than one token disabled person in it. So I think I really am keen to hopefully help with on-screen disability representation in TV comedy. And because I think even in dramas, I don't know, people are used to seeing trauma and suffering, but I want people to know that we're actually preternaturally funny as well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting that you say, like, is my work disability or themed or not, or am I just writing what I know? I know I read one article because, you know, you have a lot of essays that you've written, which I really appreciate. You talked about how, you know, it would be great to just have disabled characters as characters who happen to have disability, and I completely agree with that, and how storytelling often uses disability when they lack plot or they don't know how to use plot. What was the phrase you used for that? Like,
oh, well, it's
narrative prosthesis?
Yes, it's this thing that exists in like critical disability theory or whatever. And I did my honors thesis in screenwriting about it. But narrative prosthesis, which is just when narratives use disability as a metaphor or to prop up the plot. So, for example, this weird statistic that obviously there was next to no disability representation on Australian screen, but of the disability rep that did exist, over 70% was on Home and Away and Neighbours. Mm. And I'm like, yeah, but that's including amnesia. That's including learning to walk again after a boating accident because your evil twin brother put dynamite on your boat. That's all these, like, as we would call soap disabilities, which someone suffers through for 6 weeks and then is cured of.
Yeah.
I mean, almost no one is, like, disabled forever in Summer Bay, but most people are, you know, in reality.
Yeah, absolutely. No, I thought that was really interesting. I loved reading that article. In the show notes, I'll put links to both of your websites, but I suggest people go to the writing page. There's just a whole lot of essays and articles and some great comedy to listen to on Alistair's page. So, yeah, some really interesting stuff. What about you, Madeline? What's next for you?
I'm writing a solo show at the moment, and I feel like the more I tell people, the more I've got to do it. Yeah, so it's called So Brave. It's kind of like a coming-of-age kind of show where I realise that I'm 26, 27, I don't know how old I am now. I've lost count. And I'm just kind of realising that I live in this ableist world because, well, growing up I wasn't part of the disabled community until I was like 21, 22. And that's like the first time I actually met and started collaborating with people like myself and being more aware of all these things going on in our society that I was like, oh, ableist. Yeah. I just assumed they were part of life. But no, we can change things. And so the show is kind of coming of age where I talk about mostly like dating and these kind of the idea that disabled people aren't sexy and, you know, that kind of idea that like we're never seen in the media as sexy people or we're seen as like inspiring and courageous, but it's never so hot. Obviously, comedy material. Who loves a bit of sexual oppression?
Great.
Yeah.
Fantastic.
Hey, it's been so great to chat to you both.
It's been wonderful to chat to you.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on. This is Anthea Williams, and you are on 2RPH with Activated Arts. And now, Hannah Cormack, what have you got to tell us about this month?
First up, I have Happy Go Wrong, which is Andy Snelling's solo physical theatre odyssey about her experience with Lyme and vector-borne diseases, and it's on right now at the Adelaide Fringe.
Awesome.
This is a show I've actually been wanting to see for a few years, and not to be a fringe stargazer, but this thing is picking up 5-star reviews everywhere it tours. It's at the Bakehouse Theatre, which is wheelchair accessible, including an accessible bathroom at the venue, and there's a warning for smoke effect use. And I can't experience it, but I wish I could.
Well, look, I have a few events that you can experience, so I'll tell you about those. Both from our lovely guests today. First of all, Madeline Stewart is doing the Wheelhouse Online show, which is happening as part of the Melbourne Comedy Festival, but they do have an online event as part of that if you're not in Melbourne or if you can't get out to see it. And that's happening from the 13th to the 15th of April. And then the Sydney Writers Festival has Alistair Baldwin appearing at 3 events. The first is Laughing at the News, then Growing Up Disabled in Australia. Many of you will have read the book edited by Carly Finlay, which is fantastic, and they're doing a piece around that. And then finally, Queer Stories. I'm so pleased to be able to plug that event. I just adore it so much. But all of these things will eventually be on the podcast that the Sydney Writers Festival puts out. They have an amazing podcast, so you can get online accessibility that way. So what is it that you can see this month?
Well, what I could attend this month is the virtual tour of Reasonable Adjustment, which is an online version of Justin Edgar's Commission for Unlimited. Reasonable Adjustment, or RAD, were a disabled armed resistance movement fighting against Thatcher's austerity and its major cuts to disability funding. And they orchestrated a series of armed uprisings throughout the early 90s, including a shooting at the BBC and a bombing of Euston Station. It's a fascinating and thrilling history that collects photos, video, articles and artefacts of RAD's activism. But the real thing about this is that the RAD doesn't exist. It's all made up, though it's really sophisticatedly constructed. It's raised quite a bit of controversy, as a lot of people who saw the exhibition thought it was real. So the virtual tour offers 7 different access options, including captions, BSL, a transcript for deafblind Braille users, and a low-conflict edit. So there's a warning that there is ableist language and descriptions and images of violence. And that's at reasonableadjustmentexhibition.com.
Amazing. Hey, thank you so much, Hannah. I can't wait to hear what you're going to see and not see next month.